Hello and welcome to another podcast for U.S. History Repeated with Jimmy and Gene. This is Jimmy LaSalle. Today, we are going to cover the Holocaust. And we have a special guest today, Rebecca Earl Building from the National Holocaust Museum in Washington, D.C. We have a long one today, so without further ado, here is our resident history expert, Gene Anzanakis. Jeannie, take it away.
Today, we're going to be talking about the Holocaust and what the United States, the Allies, and people around the world knew about what was happening. Today, we're going to be joined by Rebecca Earl Building, a historian, an author, educator, and an archivist at the National Holocaust Memorial Museum in Washington, D.C. Rebecca Earl Building is the author of the book Rescue Board, The Untold Story of America's Efforts to Save the Jews of Europe. The book discusses the work of the War Refugee Board to save the lives of tens of thousands of Jewish people during the Holocaust. The term Holocaust is of Greek origin. The words in Greek holos, which means whole, and the Greek word kostos, which means burned. The term Holocaust was used because of the preferred method of killing Jewish people and the use of crematoriums in order to burn the bodies. The term Holocaust, of course, refers to the systematic and the state-sponsored killing of 6 million men, women, and children. It is also referred to as the Shoah. Shoah is a Hebrew biblical term, which means catastrophe. The Nazis not only murdered 6 million Jewish people, they also murdered political opponents, individuals with disabilities, homosexuals, Roma gypsies, even Jehovah's Witnesses. I hope that after listening to our discussion, you'll be inspired to learn more about the Holocaust, to take time to learn about the individual stories of survivors and victims. Yes. Okay, today we are joined by Rebecca Earl Building. Rebecca, welcome.
Thank you so much for having me.
Can you tell us a little bit about what you do at the museum?
Sure. So I have worked at the United States Holocaust Memorial Museum for the past 21 years. I started working with the museum's personal collections, helping survivors and liberators and their families who were donating material to the collection. And now I'm a historian at the museum. So I have a PhD in American history and I focus on American responses to the Holocaust. And my job at the museum is to work with teachers. So I work with my colleagues, many of whom were classroom teachers, to develop resources for middle and high school teachers and make sure that those resources are free and accessible and fit learning standards for all kinds of different learners and learning environments.
Excellent. Excellent. You know, today we are going to be talking about the Holocaust and the United States's response to it. What did we know? When did we know? What did we do about it? When we talk about the Holocaust, you know, people get that this was a systematic mass murder of 6 million Jews in Europe. Now, some historians will look at this as taking place from the time period of 1941 to 1945. Others will look back and say, no, we have to go back and start this in 1933 when Hitler gains control in Europe. Which do you think is a better starting off point?
I think both historians are right in the technical sense. So mass murder began in 1941, but I think we know that it doesn't start with mass murder. It starts with words. It starts with laws. It starts with marginalizing Jewish people within German society. And then as the Nazis start to take over other areas, it's marginalizing Jews in those societies as well. And so I really think it's important to start in 1933, because that allows students and teachers and all of us to really see how and why this sort of thing can happen.
In Germany in 1933, you know, one of the first things to happen was that citizenship was taken away from Jewish people, and Jewish people did not have the full protection of the law in Germany. Can you talk a little bit about that?
Sure. So the first thing that happens when Adolf Hitler is appointed chancellor in Germany is the Nazi party, which is now controlling the German state, starts to strip Jews of rights. So Jews are kicked out of the civil service. Many Jewish students can no longer attend public school. The Nazi Party stages a nationwide boycott on Jewish-owned businesses in Germany, and they burn books written by Jewish authors and other people who are considered to be non-German or not representing the ideas of the new German state. And then in 1935, you're right, German Jews are stripped of their citizenship. There are new restrictions on who they can marry, who they can have relationships with, who they can employ, and who can be employed by them. And so they really do start to very quickly and then slowly over time just continue and continue and continue to make life incredibly difficult for German Jews with the goal of forcing them out of the country, making life so terrible that they will voluntarily immigrate out of Germany.
And the first sort of idea was, well, let's get Jewish people within the Reich, within Germany, to leave. And so there was this movement of Jewish people out of Germany, but they go to territories that will eventually be absorbed by Germany as they begin their conquest of the continent.
Right. That's one of the tragic things about this. If you think about the story of Anne Frank, Anne Frank and her family were refugees. They were German refugees. They had left Germany in 1933 and they went to the Netherlands. Otto Frank reestablished a business there. And I think many families did the same thing. They would go to places like Belgium or the Netherlands or France with the idea of, well, when Hitler is out, when the Nazi Party is out of Germany, then we will come back. We'll reestablish our lives. We'll reunite with our families and we'll go back to Germany. You know, these were places where many of these families had lived for thousands of years. So this, the decision to leave was not easy. And I think many people hoped that they would be able to go home.
Yeah. And the world knows that this is happening. You know, we're very much aware of these laws that are being passed. And you don't have to look much further than the debate that takes place within the United States on the government level of, you know, do we send our athletes to Berlin for the 1936 Olympics?
Yeah, you know? You're spot on. There's front page newspaper articles in the spring of 1933, when Hitler's only been in power for 2 months, talking about the boycotts, talking about book burning, talking about all of the things that are happening. And those articles are headline news right next to the New Deal, right next to the end of Prohibition, right next to everything else that is happening in the early Roosevelt administration. And there is enough information that when it comes time for Germany to host the winter and the summer games in 1936, Americans really do debate whether or not we should send athletes or whether the U.S. should boycott the games. It would have been the first boycott in modern Olympic history. And by a very slim margin, the United States decides to go. It's a massive propaganda for victory for Germany that the U.S. goes, because they send, you know, Americans go, they send tourists, and people walk around. And the Nazis, of course, have disguised some of the open anti-Semitism because they don't want American tourists and foreign visitors to see it. And so all of these people come to Germany and they marvel at the clean streets and the wonderful food and the very nice people. And all of what the Nazis are actually doing has been subsumed under the surface. And that was a deliberate decision by the Nazi Party to create a propaganda victory for Germany.
Yes. And in turn, you know, when journalists are writing about what they see, oh, it's not so bad. You know, they're not doing this. I didn't see it when I was there. But when the games are over, it goes right back to what was happening. And that is the very sad truth about it, is that the world knows. The world goes, sees really mostly positive things, and then leaves.
Yeah. And they say it couldn't have been that bad. All of the things that the journalists are saying must not be true, or they're just exaggerating for a story. It's not that bad.
Yeah. And then you look at the events of 1938, you look at Kristallnacht, and again, it's front page news around the world.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, Kristallnacht is front page news. It is a bigger news story than the 20th anniversary of the end of World War I, which is that same week. And it's also the same week as the midterm elections in 1938. And this is a bigger story than that. Can you imagine something being a bigger story than the midterm elections, a foreign news story? being a bigger story, but that's what happens with Kristallnacht. It is front page news for about 3 weeks all throughout the United States. Big papers, small papers, this is the story that everybody's reading about.
At what point do the Nazis begin to round up the Jewish people and begin putting them into ghettos?
It's an interesting question, and it's different by country. So the first time that there's a mass roundup of Jews just for being Jewish is Kristallnacht. Jewish men and boys are arrested, about 30,000 of them, and sent to concentration camps. Many of them are released thereafter, because at that point in 1938 and early 1939, again, the Nazi Party policy was forced immigration. And so people could get out of camps if they could show that they were actively trying to leave Germany. It's really when the Nazis invade Poland that they really start creating ghettos and forcing Jews to move into ghettos. And those ghettos are at that point holding places, because the Nazis are not quite sure what to do with all of these Jews. And then by 1941, when the Nazis invade the Soviet Union, they've made the decision to begin the process of mass murder.
Or Jewish people who are now forced to move into ghettos, what is that time frame like? When are they notified? Is it a question of somebody knocking on your door demanding that you leave? Is it a question of notices being put up throughout the neighborhood saying on such and such a date you have to be gone? What does that process look like?
Yeah, it's different wherever you live. If you're in a city where the ghetto is created, you might find out on the street, you might find out through the Jewish community. If you're in a smaller farming community and are being moved into a ghetto in a city, you'll get a notice or someone will knock on your door and you are told that, you know, you have a day or two to gather all your belongings, dispose of your home, dispose of your pets, and move to the ghetto. So it really changes kind of all over Europe. It changes depending on your living situation. There's no one answer to that question.
You know, you think of somebody knocking on your door and telling you you have a day, maybe two, to kind of pack up your things. You don't know where you're going. And then it becomes a question of, well, what do I take? What am I going to need? And, you know, I look at myself, I look at my family, and I think it's hard not to look at it from that perspective of what types of things can you cram into two suitcases and say, do I have everything that we're all going to need? You bring, you know, cooking utensils, do you bring plates, do you bring sheets and towels, you bring clothes, you bring medication. You know, you're essentially packing up the essentials. And I also think the things that we individually would consider our prized possessions. And that, of course, changes from person to person of what you consider your prized possessions. And, you know, that is one of the really heartbreaking things. If, you know, you think of these families, these are families that are being forced out of a home, being sent to a place that they don't know. And now they're thrusted into a very different living situation. What was the typical experience like in the Jewish ghettos?
Oh, gosh. Again, like it depends on time. It depends on place. We can talk about the Warsaw Ghetto, which was one of the largest. That was a place where Jews were confined within the city of Warsaw. And it was horrible. There was forced labor for many of the adults. Food was always scarce. There were epidemics of disease that the Nazis tried to deal with, mainly because the Nazis did not want to get sick. They didn't really care if the people in the ghetto got sick, but they didn't want any of these communicable diseases to spread into the Nazis. And people are there for years. And the situation just deteriorates as more and more people are moved into the ghetto. It just becomes more and more crowded. And then in the summer of 1942, deportations begin from the ghetto to the Treblinka killing center. And it's pretty clear to many of the people living within the ghetto that that is what is happening. There had already been a movement within some members of the among the ghetto residents to kind of commemorate what is happening, knowing that most of them will probably not live through the experience. And so they start to collect diaries and letters and placards that the Nazis have put up on the streets, and drawings, and creating an archive of what life was like in the ghetto so that eventually someone would remember what they had all been through. And that is one of the most, I think, interesting and also illuminating archives that we have, is the archive actually created by residents of the ghetto to document their own lives. And they created it for us. They created it so that we would know what happened to them. It wasn't for them. It was for us.
Is there any evidence within the ghettos of life attempting to kind of continue on, especially for the children? Is there stories of schooling? Is there a story of religious ceremonies still taking place?
Yeah, of course. Of course. Families wanted their children to continue their education. And so there were clandestine schools set up with volunteer teachers or people who had been teachers outside of the ghetto, setting up their own schools, setting up their own bar mitzvah training, setting up all kinds of ways to both keep the students occupied and continue their educations. It is one of, I think, the most inspiring things in the Holocaust generally, is how dedicated people were to continuing their life for as long as possible and continuing their educations for as long as possible. Again, going back to the story of Anne Frank, you know, she and her sister are getting correspondence courses sent to one of their helpers, who then passes it on to them, and they're working on their Latin and they're reading books, and they're trying really hard to make sure that hopefully when this ends and they've survived, they can pick up their lives. And that is true within the ghettos as well.
You know, it was not possible to really hide the movement of Jewish people to ghettos, and then once from the ghettos to the concentration camps. What did governments of Great Britain, France, you know, the United States, and eventually the Soviet Union, when they joined forces, what did they know of what was happening?
This is also something that is specific to each country. In the United States, diplomats leave Poland alongside the Polish government. So once Germany invades Poland, the Polish government goes into exile, and American diplomats follow the Polish government into exile. And so from really the spring of 1939 or so on, there aren't American diplomats on the ground reporting back from what is happening within Poland. And there aren't American reporters really reporting back what they're seeing and hearing. And so a lot of what Americans could read about were things that were coming from secondhand sources. So from the Polish government in London, or from Soviet reporters or Soviet sources. And Americans are kind of distrustful of those sources. Remember, the United States does not get involved in the war until December 1941. And so mass murder had already begun by that point. This is 2 years after, 2.5 years after Germany invades, or almost 2.5 years after Germany invades Poland. So there's a really long time in which the ghettos are happening and Americans are not really hearing that many firsthand stories about them. The British have a bit more information, I think, than the Americans do, particularly once mass murder begins. Churchill is getting updates for a while on shootings that are taking place, mass shootings of Jews. And that was done largely through intercepting German reports. And he didn't say anything publicly because he didn't want to let the Germans know that they had intercepted those reports. The Soviets have much more information because a lot of the mass murder is happening on Soviet soil. And the Soviets, you remember, were actually allied with Nazi Germany for a while. They are allied with Germany from August 1939 to June 1941. And the Soviets take over the eastern half of Poland during that time. And so they are very aware of the ghettos that are happening right across the border. And then, you know, ghettoization happens in Soviet, in what had been Soviet territory, once Germany invades that area. And that's also when those ghettos are much shorter lived, because in many towns, the Nazis don't even put up a ghetto. They just round people up and shoot them.
For the United States, you know, you mentioned we don't get involved until December of 1941 after the attack on Pearl Harbor. But there is a movement within the United States to help, especially the children of war-torn Britain, right? We are bringing in British children. We're finding them safe places to live within the United States. There are calls to do the same thing for Jewish children, but that does not happen.
It doesn't happen in the same numbers. It does happen, but not nearly as many, and only after the efforts for British children have ended. So there is an effort in early 1939 to kind of mimic the kinder transports, the transports that are taking about 10,000 mostly Jewish children to Great Britain and to France and to Belgium, out of Germany, which then at that point controlled Austria and parts of Czechoslovakia. And there's a call to do the same thing to the United States, to bring 20,000 German refugee children, 10,000 in 1939, and 10,000 in 1940. That bill, there are hearings about the bill in Congress, but that bill dies. That bill is never even voted out of committee, in part because there were so many anti-immigrant Congress people in the United States and senators that many of them said, you know, we will only vote for your child refugee bill if we can attach it to bills that will stop all other immigration. And so the sponsors of the bill knew that it was also important to get other immigrants out, to get other families out, and that the numbers would actually be higher if they didn't try to push their child refugee bill through. And so that bill is never voted on. Then once the Blitz begins, you're right, American companies and universities sponsor groups of British kids to come to the US. When that effort ends, and British families start sending their kids to, you know, Scotland and Wales instead, then there are groups that start focusing on bringing mostly Jewish kids from southern France, families who are in French internment camps, who, you know, sign over their kids, basically, with the idea that this organization, the U.S. Committee for the Care of European Children, which had Eleanor Roosevelt as its chairwoman, that they would bring these kids to the United States and place them either with family members or with foster families. And so there's about 320 kids who come as late as 1942 to the U.S. And are placed with other families.
For the camps themselves, I mean, I myself have visited Auschwitz. I have taken a number of students to Poland. We went, we walked around the camp. It's exactly what you read it to be and everything you don't expect it to be all at the same time. Before I visited, I had very mixed feelings about going. I don't like to refer to it as a tourist attraction. I think it is hallowed ground. I think it is a window into history. I think it is something that if you have the opportunity to go see, I think you have to see it. I think you do yourself a disservice if you don't. And I think you do the world a disservice if you don't. Standing along those train tracks right before you enter, and you have that. And I'm sure most people have seen the images of the gate and, you know, Arbeit macht frei, you know, work will set you free. And it's hard to not immediately go back to what was probably the chaos of arrival. People were transported on cattle cars. They're spending days on a train, standing up, no place to sit. There's no food. There's no water. There's no place to use the bathroom. So you have to understand that by the time people arrive, they're pretty weak. They're pretty sickly. You get off of this
cattle car, there's men with guns, and you're immediately separated. For the survivors that you have worked with at your time in the museum, what are some of the things that they have said about their arrival at the camps?
I mean, I think you nailed it. This idea of being weak, of the dogs barking, of just the noise, the cacophony of sounds and smells that you can't quite place, and noises that are terrifying. And then this immediate separation, and the separation happens for many people so quickly. You know, maybe a glance, maybe one or two words before you are pulled away from someone you love. And that is the last time you see them. And I think for many people, it had to be explained to them that you would never see that person again. And so if you look at a lot of survivor testimony, they talk about wondering when they would be reunited with their loved one, and fellow prisoners having to explain that they wouldn't be, that this is not a place in which that happens. And so it's a lot of confusion in the first couple of days, and trying to make sense of this place, which doesn't make any sense at all.
The camps, when I visited, it was the end of March. It was unbelievably cold. It had snowed, you know, a couple of days before we had arrived. And I always say it took me days to warm up after I got home. I was like in this consistent hunched state. I was so cold. And we were dressed appropriately, right? We had on heavy clothing. We had on thermals. We had on sweaters. We had on jackets, hats, gloves, you know, thick winter boots. But the chill that just did not leave your body, it's hard to explain. And we're walking around and you're thinking, look at what we have on compared to what the prisoners of the camps had. They had these very thin, thin blue and white pajamas, in essence. And you're saying to yourself, well, how did they sort of survive? And, you know, one of the things that we were shown upon entry, one of the first things was the fact that the camps were looked at. The Salvation Army kind of comes in, and the Red Cross comes in, and they're like, you know, well, we want to take a look at what these camps are like. And they're showing them, well, here, this is how we heat the barracks. And, you know, they're showing them a very different reality than what was actually happening. And so when you walk around and you're seeing all of these latrines lined up, you're seeing the fact that people are laying with just no space to move. There's three layers of I don't want to call them beds, but where people are sleeping, right? If one person turned, everyone had to turn. The infighting that took place of people wanting the highermost part of those barracks, because people would use the bathroom in the middle of the night. And so if you were on the middle, if you were on the bottom, that was something that you were going to be exposed to. The idea of, you know, being served in a poor excuse for maybe coffee in the morning to kind of warm you up, a soup of some sort to eat, you know, in the middle of the day. And that was supposed to kind of give you sustenance to do the work that was expected of you in order for you to be able to survive another day. For people who go to the camps, one of the first things that's done is, you know, the heads are shaved. And I don't think people realize the true meaning behind wanting the hair. In the museum at Auschwitz, that's the one room where you're not permitted to take pictures. And the hair are mostly in braids, and it's just this mountain of hair. Did people really know what the Germans were planning to do with these types of things?
When you say people, which people do you mean?
The average German citizen, leaders of the world, did people know?
Leaders of the world, no. Leaders of the world generally do not have that kind of detailed information about what is happening in the camps until afterwards. The average German, probably not either. The killing centers were deliberately in German-controlled territory, not within Germany proper. And that was to some extent to try to keep information from the German people. I don't think the average German recognized that some human hair was being used for commercial purposes. They may not have recognized it as human hair or may not have understood that this was hair from people who had been murdered. Jews who had their heads shaven certainly understood the dehumanization aspect of it. And that was a major part of it. There were a couple reasons why people had their heads shaven. One is lice. Lice spread disease. The less hair you have, the fewer lice, though, of course, that didn't stop the lice from infecting a lot of people with diseases like typhus. But you also have the dehumanization. You know, it's not enough to be taken away from your family. It's not enough to be taken away from your home. You are given a number and referred to by that number within the camp. In Auschwitz specifically, that number is tattooed onto your body against your will. That only happens at Auschwitz. And your head is shaven. And especially for women, that was a violation for many Jewish women. And also, it's hard to recognize people. You're not used to seeing a woman without hair. And so, you know, it was a violation of people's identities to do that. And that was deliberate on the part of the Nazis. They wanted people to feel inhuman because they were about to be treated as inhuman.
When the world does find out about the camps, what is in the papers?
So the United States, I'll be specific about the United States because it does change depending on where you are. The American people and the US government learn that mass murder is happening in the summer and fall of 1942. So it is in American newspapers in November 1942 that the Nazis have a plan to murder Jews, that probably 2 million people have already been murdered. We know that that's an understatement even by 1942. By February 1943, about 4.5 million people have been murdered. At that point, the Allied military is in North Africa, so they have not yet made it to the European continent. And this is the time when the killing centers are really in operation. It will take another year and a half, really, for really detailed information to come out. November 1944, the U.S. releases a report about Auschwitz that they had received from two escapees from Auschwitz. It's a very detailed report, even with drawings of some of the buildings at the camp, a map of the camp that the escaped prisoners had drawn, and lots of detailed information about the process of arrival and selection and gassing. The prisoners estimate at that point that about 1.6 million people have been murdered at Auschwitz, which we know is an overstatement, that Auschwitz, that about 1.1 million people were murdered at Auschwitz, not 1.7. But it says a lot that the escapees understand that the number is in the millions, that they had witnessed enough to know that millions of people were being murdered. That's in newspapers in November 1944. At that point, the U.S. has a policy of rescue and relief, of trying to save Jews in Europe. But the main policy is we are going to win the war as soon as possible. That is the way that we can save the most people. That is the way we can actually stop the Nazis, is we have to defeat them militarily. And so the U.S., not in response to this report, but is already doing its best to try to win the war early and as soon as possible. And so really the moment when Americans actually have the most information and grasp the most of it is the spring of 1945, when the American military liberates some of the concentration camps, never the killing centers. The American military doesn't reach the killing centers, but the concentration camps in Buchenwald and Dachau and Mauthausen, and American reporters and journalists are encouraged to come and see and witness and share newsreels and photographs with the American people, because Dwight Eisenhower, the future president, who was the head of the Allied military, said he didn't want this ever to be thought of as propaganda. He wanted the American people to understand that this had really happened.
Yeah. For the people, when, as the camps are liberated, what happens to the survivors? I mean, is it a question of bringing in immediate medical care? Is it a question of providing more food, but having to be careful not to give too much food at first because they had been so malnourished for so long?
Yes, both of those things. So it's bringing in medical care from allied doctors. And then at first, you know, soldiers are giving over their rations because they can't believe what they're seeing. They see starving people, they want to feed them. And it quickly becomes clear that if you've been starving for a long time, you just can't consume that many calories at once. And so there are stories of newly liberated prisoners actually dying because they had tried to eat too much. And so very quickly, it's explained to soldiers that they need to not do that. They need to trust the doctors, and the doctors and nurses come in and they set up ultimately displaced persons camps. The U.S. Military and the United Nations Relief and Rehabilitation Administration set up displaced persons camps. Originally, they do not separate Jewish survivors from non-Jewish survivors. And then ultimately they realize, no, the Nazis treated Jews differently. We need to give them special consideration as well. They have been through, in many cases, many more years of deprivation than some of the other groups. Some newly liberated survivors don't want to stay in these displaced persons camps. They want to go back to their hometowns and see what happened to everyone, with the idea that, you know, if you were split up from a family member, your meeting place is back home. So many of them try to go to their homes, largely in Eastern Europe, and come to discover that their homes have been taken over, sometimes by their neighbors, that some of those neighbors threaten violence, thinking, you know, why did you survive? I have a nice house now. I have your things. Like, you can't come back and claim them. They're mine now. And so many of the people who do try to go home find out, unfortunately, that they are the only survivors and that there's nothing left for them in their hometowns. And so they try to make it back to displaced persons camps, where some of them live for years, you know, trying to find some place to go. The United States does not immediately open its doors. The British control immigration to Palestine, which is now Israel, and are limiting the number of people who can go there. And so a lot of people are kind of stuck in this limbo of wanting to reestablish their lives. But even after the Holocaust, even after everybody's seen the images of liberation, the countries of the world tend not to open their doors.
For the survivors, you know, the stories of so many who are essentially the lone survivor of their family, what percentage of was there of people who were able to find family members, and how did they go about finding them?
I don't know about a percentage. Tracing was one of the first priorities of most of the survivors, and it was something that the Allies were really unprepared to help with. You know, they were ready for medical care. They were ready to kind of keep policing in line and that sort of thing. And they weren't ready to try to figure out how to trace people. So the American Red Cross and the International Red Cross step in and start to help with that. And they start to use all of the captured records that the Allies have taken from camps and taken from German bureaucratic offices. And they start to try to compile lists. They also take inventories of, here's everybody who is liberated from this place. Here's everybody who is in this current displaced persons camp. And they would send those lists out. And so there are amazing photos and amazing stories of survivors who would spend their days, you know, reading these lists that were posted publicly in the different camps. And then seeing a name or seeing the name of a friend, and then trying to hitchhike or trying to like make their way on foot or getting a bicycle and trying to make their way to a different camp to just find somebody that they knew. And so there are really kind of miraculous stories of people who do manage to find a sibling or a friend after 4, 5, 6 years, just by reading one of these lists.
You know, it's really incredible. You know, you speak of people having the sense of, well, let me go to home base. Let me go back to my home. Let me see who I can find. And then the response that people got from their neighbors and the people who took their homes, you know, there wasn't, I mean, the loss of life is certainly at the top when you look at the hierarchy of things that were lost, but it's also your loss of your home, your business, your belongings, whatever, you know, amount of wealth that you had. It's also a loss of your sense of belonging. You know, where do I belong? Where can I go and be embraced and be welcomed? There's a loss of all of that. Mm-hmm. And I, you know, for the survivors, what is done to try to provide some sort of reparations for them?
Well, it takes a long time to provide any sort of financial reparations. Within the displaced persons camp, organizations, many of whom are still existing today, like the Joint, are setting up classes so that people can get training again. I think this is going back to an earlier question. I think this is one of the reasons that education was so important to people, is that education is portable. It can't be taken away from you. And I think particularly Jewish communities who had been through pogroms in the past understood that belongings can be taken. Your home can be taken, but your education can't be. And so that was something that people particularly valued. And so classes get set up. People start taking English classes in the hopes that they would, you know, eventually be able to get to the United States or somewhere where English is being spoken. One of the things that I think is really beautiful about the displaced persons camp experience is so many people married. And that to me says so much about humanity, that you could be through something like the Holocaust, have your family taken away from you, and you're one of the first things that you do is you fall in love or you meet someone and you decide that you're going to start another family, that you're going to start a family with them and you're going to have children. And it's the biggest kind of reaction to the Holocaust is you thought you killed us and we are going to have more children and we are going to live. I think that's one of the things that people do. But in terms of reparations, I don't particularly think that survivors, you know, are still not given a place to go for a long time.
No.
And so the reparations they're getting are classes, are, you know, let's keep you calm, let's give you something to do, but it's not let's help you really build your future in any sort of more meaningful way.
I agree. And I think reparations in general, which I don't typically like to generalize anything in history, but if you're looking at it from an across the board perspective, reparations tend to be very symbolic in nature. There is no way that you can put a dollar amount on what was lost,
right?
Especially when it comes to a human life. What dollar amount takes that loss away? It doesn't erase it, doesn't make up for it. It you cannot come close. And, you know, I have had the good fortune in my life to meet and speak with a number of Holocaust survivors. And I think you hit the nail on the head. One of the biggest things that I always took away from those conversations was the resolve, the fact that in the face of such horrific loss, and I think people can, for the most part, when you have suffered a horrible loss, you can empathize with somebody in a way that you would not have been able to without having been through a loss that completely turns your life upside down, where the world is you know, has lost its color, it's blurry, and you don't even know where to begin. And in the face of that experience, there is also this resolve of, I will not allow this to define the rest of my life. I will move on. And I hate the term move on. I think the better way to word it is, I will carry forward. You don't move on. Because when you move on, it's like that check, that's over and done with.
Yeah, you're not
and
forget.
You don't forget. You take that experience and you carry forward and you keep moving, not always because you want to, but because you have to. And in the midst of that have to, it becomes a want to, right? And, you know, for you and for your work, which is so incredibly important, when you look around the museum, what are some of the things that you wish most people knew and you hope that when people visit the museum, they leave with that?
Well, as I've said, my expertise and the thing that I talk most about is American response to the Holocaust. And I think it's important for people to understand that Americans had information about what was happening. They didn't always know what to do with that information. The information wasn't always complete, but it was there. You know, it was not a surprise that the Nazis were anti-Semitic. It was not a surprise that their anti-Semitism was violent. It was not a surprise that Jews in Germany and then Jews in Europe generally were considered a threat, and that threat was a dire one, that they needed help. And Americans are sympathetic to what is happening, but they're not willing to be part of the solution. And I think the thing that resonates the most with me is you look around the world now and there seem to be so many crises and you don't know where to look. And I think there's a tendency that we all have of, well, if I can't fix it, then there's nothing I can do. And I don't agree with that. And I think what the Holocaust to some extent teaches us, but American response definitely does, is there's always something that we can do. We can write a letter. We can reach out to a neighbor. We can try to help in the small ways in which we can help. And if everybody did that, there would be a different outcome. If neighbors had looked out for neighbors in Europe and had not kind of turned inward, the Holocaust could not have happened the way that it did. You know, the Nazis can't act alone. They need local collaborators. They need people who are willing to turn in their neighbors. They need lots of people to say, this is not my problem. And it's the same in the US. The US does ultimately respond to what is happening in the Holocaust, but it takes a very long time. And it takes a long time because people are saying, well, we have bigger problems. We have other things that we need to do. We're sympathetic, but we can't deal with this right now. And there's always these small things that we can do. And I think reminding ourselves that we can't always do big things, but we can do small things. And that those small things, if everybody does them, or if a majority of us do them, they add up and they make the world better. And so I think that's one of the things that I think about when I look around the museum is, what are the small ways in which I can try to fix the world today? They might be very small, but they're real.
For people today, and it was one of the things that we discussed in our, you know, in our conversation in preparation for today, is there's so much news. You have events like Kristallnacht in newspapers. It comes around same time as, you know, the anniversary of World War One. It comes around the same time as midterm elections, and it's like on to the next. And how this question of how do we get people to continue to care enough about something in order to enact real change?
Yeah. And this is one of the big questions. I mean, if you look back at history, civil rights movements, the suffragette movement, all of these things take years, sometimes take decades of work, of sustained work. And we want the like quick fix. And sometimes it's just not going to be a quick fix. But this systemic change is really important. And so I think it's reminding ourselves that if it's a cause we care about, we need to keep caring about it. We need to keep paying attention to it. We need to keep calling attention to it. We just need to keep participating in our democracy, or things will just not get better.
People today, it always surprises me how little my students knew about not only just the Holocaust, you know, major, major events. You know, I remember this one time we always had to do this unit on world religions. And, you know, you briefly touch on all of these different faiths around the world. And we had been talking about Christianity and, you know, and I move on. And this one student in the back raises their hand and goes, "What happened to that guy?" And I said, "What guy?" And he goes, "You know, that guy up on that cross." And I was like, "Jesus?" You know, and it kind of surprised me how little. But if it's not your, if the faith is not yours, you don't know it.
Right.
In the same sense that if you know, most people who are Jewish have an understanding of what the Holocaust is and what it means to them as being Jewish, what it has meant to their family. But if you're not, it always surprised me. This was news. They had no idea. And when you bring it up and as you discuss it and as you kind of peel away these layers of it, you see their eyes kind of open up like saucers and, you know, kind of saying, "Well, how does this happen?" Well, look at the horrible things that happen, you know, and if you make it really, really small, look at that child that's sitting all alone at the table in the cafeteria. Everybody sees them. Nobody mm-hmm. goes over and sits with them. There's somebody that's being picked on or being laughed at. Maybe you don't laugh, but you also didn't stop it either. So you look at these very, very small moments that are happening within this ecosystem of the school and say, well, now it's happening on a neighborhood level. It's happening on a city level. It's happening on a state level. And, you know, you look at, and I always give them that quote, you know, "All that's necessary for evil to succeed is for good men to do nothing." You stand by, you watch, you say, "Well, you know, it's not me. It's not happening to me." And that same concept of how do you get people to care enough about something long enough to enact real change?
Yeah. I mean, that really resonates with me because I didn't know anything about the Holocaust growing up. I didn't grow up in a Jewish family. And my Girl Scout troop visited the Holocaust Museum when I was 12. And that was that eye-opening moment for me. And I went home and I read everything I could think of, exactly as you said, of trying to figure out, well, how could this have happened? And now I've dedicated my life to trying to understand that for myself and trying to ask other people to think about it too. And I think your story of marginalized people in a community is also really resonant. This is not the Holocaust. What is happening to them is not the Holocaust, but the Holocaust begins when people stop recognizing the people around them as fellow human beings.
Yes.
When they stop thinking about how that person's experience might be affecting them, or, you know, what can we do to help that person feel included in our community? And so I think it is something that students shouldn't feel like they have to be a rescuer. Sometimes when we talk about rescuer stories, you know, this person risked their lives to save their life to save somebody during the Holocaust. And students then look around and say, "Well, like, there's nobody at risk in my world. And so, you know, that's very cool, but I can't do anything like that." And you can rescue take so many different forms. And I think it doesn't, you can be a helper without risking your life. And then maybe it won't get to a place where you would ever have to risk your life if you're a helper now. And so that's the other thing is I like it when teachers can point out all of the kind of small stories. You know, there's a survivor who volunteers at the museum who remembers, you know, his family's cook saving his mother's cookbooks for them, with the idea that they would come back. And they did. And we have the museum's cookbooks in our collection. And he's actually partnered with a chef who makes the recipes. It's really beautiful. But that cook was not risking her life by saving the cookbooks. People were not risking their lives hugging their neighbors before their neighbors were deported, but it was a reminder that I see you as a person.
Yeah.
I see you as a human being and I remember you, and what is happening is terrible and I'm not going to treat you like that.
Yeah. And you know, I think that's what I hope that people will take away from our discussion today and this episode is, you know, there's no way to talk about everything. It's so extensive, but you know, we always end our podcast with there's always more to learn, which there is. And what we hope to do is to kind of plant the seed, just like you when you were 12 years old and you visited the museum with the Girl Scouts. It's planting the seed of hoping that people will want to know more and be encouraged to whatever it was that they found interesting about this discussion, that they will take that and take the opportunity to learn more. But I thank you for your time. I thank you for your expertise. And I hope that people will look you up and look up your book and read it.
Yes. Thank you so much. And go to the museum's website. There's so much you can learn on the Holocaust Museum's website.
Great. Thank you so much.
All right. Well, thank you for listening to U.S. History Repeated with Jimmy and Gene. Tell your friends about our podcast and where you learn all this great stuff about U.S. history. Follow us on social media and get onto our email list to learn about special events. They're coming up again. There's always more to learn. Talk to you soon.